This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Sweden and Finland want in on NATO. If they do eventually join, then other countries might follow.
The question then, though, is, well, if the Finns and the Swedes can join, then why not Ukraine?
Also today, Dr. Oz.
My parents came to America to find a better life.
Dr. Oz is running for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania. His parents came from Turkey, and in Turkey, he's a favorite son. But political opponents here question his loyalty to the U.S. And President Biden invited Southeast Asian leaders to Washington. He touted a new era of relations and offered $150 million in aid. These days, though, that amount of support?
I think it's pretty insulting, to be honest.
Plus, no big surprise at Eurovision. Ukraine wins with a sympathy vote and a rocking tune. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. For more than two centuries, Sweden has remained neutral in armed conflicts. This weekend, Sweden made a pivot. It's applying for membership in NATO along with its neighbor Finland. To better understand the implications of what would happen if NATO expanded, we now turn to Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's the CEO of New America, a Washington-based think tank. Anne-Marie, how significant is Sweden's announcement?
It's a very big change, and it is definitely a change that Putin has brought on himself. The Finns and the Swedes publicly want security that they long believed they could provide for themselves and now no longer do.
So both Finland and Sweden are saying that joining NATO is in their country's best interest, but what are NATO's interests?
So this is a complicated question. I mean, I'm all for the security of the Finns and the Swedes, indeed, as for all Europeans. And if the only way to get that security is through joining NATO, then I would say they should join NATO. The question then, though, is, well, if the Finns and the Swedes can join, then why not Ukraine? What's the difference? I mean, Finland borders Russia, a 1,000-kilometer border. Obviously, Ukraine does as well. We're pouring money and arms into Ukraine to fight for that government. And I think it's going to be very hard for NATO to say yes to Finland and Sweden, but no to Ukraine, to Georgia, to Moldova, to other countries that have traditionally been bordering Russia rather than in what was Western Europe and then Central Europe, now to full Eastern Europe. So I think it does have big implications for NATO. And I think NATO needs to think very hard, as does the European Union and all Europeans, about a European security architecture that extends beyond the victors of World War II.
Well, that was something that French President Emmanuel Macron is kind of alluding to lately, right?
It is. And I think the French are at least exploring alternatives on the traditional Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, a Europe whole and free and at peace. And of course, I said the victors of World War II. Of course, the Soviet Union suffered more than any other country in World War II and was a victor. But then the ideological divide between communism and capitalism was also the security divide.
So how receptive is NATO, and France is a member, to Macron's suggestion that Europe think more expansively about security pacts, well, Europe and the U.S.?
Well, I think one of the interesting possibilities is that the Nordic countries may well also have a vision of NATO that can expand, but expand in different ways. That will profoundly change the nature of the current alliance, all based on Article 5, because it will have to start thinking about how you really do guarantee the security of countries all the way up to a Russia that is one day no longer ruled by Putin or one of his cronies.
Let me get back to your question, Anne-Marie. What is the difference between Ukraine wanting to join and Sweden and Finland possibly joining? Would Putin see that differently?
Putin, of course, says that Ukraine is not a separate country, that it is part of Russia. He would not say that about Finland or Sweden, although he might try to say it about parts of Finland. So he sees a difference. But of course, The other NATO countries don't accept that claim. And before this war, many NATO countries would have said Ukraine is not a stable democracy. We don't see it like other NATO countries. I think that's a very hard line to draw these days.
If Sweden and Finland do join NATO, do you see more countries wanting to join? I mean, where could NATO expand from there?
I mean, this is, again, the question that has not been resolved since the aughts when George W. Bush said Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, these are countries that at least should be considered to join NATO. And that wasn't followed up on because, again, effectively, NATO was saying, no, they're not part of the West.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, do you worry that that kind of rhetoric, starting with George W. Bush, has basically put Putin on the back and defensive foot since the aughts?
I definitely think that Putin is not unreasonably focused on the expansion of a Cold War alliance. You know, when Russia or the Soviet Union put missiles into Cuba, the United States reacted in a way that put the whole world on the brink of nuclear war. So it's not unreasonable to say that when an alliance that was founded against the Soviet Union is spreading ever closer to the borders of Russia, that that is a threat. I don't think that's the only reason that Putin is invading Ukraine. I think at the time in the mid-1990s, it was hard to figure out what other structures former Soviet bloc countries could join, which is one reason that Macron is now suggesting that the EU develop a kind of outer ring of integration that many more countries could join. But what's done is done. I think now the question is, what is a real European security and economic architecture that actually prospectively includes all of Europe?
Anne-Marie Slaughter is the CEO of New America. She served as a director of policy planning for the U.S. State Department from 2009 to 2011. Anne-Marie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
The Eurovision Song Contest. It's not supposed to be political, but this year it couldn't not be.
Україна переможець Євробачення 2022!
The unadulterated joy there of Ukraine's own Eurovision commentator, Timur Miroshichenko, working from the safety of an underground bomb shelter in Kyiv the moment the country's own Kalush Orchestra was announced as this year's winner in Turin, Italy.
Stefania, mama, mama, Stefania.
Kalush Orchestra's winning song, Stefania, mixes Ukrainian folk lyrics with other verses in rap. As much attention as this song got, a lullaby sung by a grandmother to a boy, an ode, according to the band, to mothers everywhere, it took on a political aspect by virtue of the war in Ukraine. The first time Ukraine won Eurovision was in 2004, when number two came in 2016, 2 years after the Russian annexation of Crimea. That year's entry, a song titled 1944, was overtly political, an homage to the entire Tatar population in Crimea, who were deported en masse by Joseph Stalin. The singer in 2016 was Jamala. She was inspired by the story of her own great-grandmother's deportation and wrote the song herself in English and Crimean Tatar.
When strangers are coming, they come to your house. They kill you all and say, we're not guilty.
Jamala took the prize for Ukraine 6 years ago. Sadly, that song is still relevant in 2022.
Where's your heart? Humanity rise. You think you're gods, but everyone dies. Don't swallow my soul. Our souls.
The global supply chain backup remains a problem. You might be painfully aware of that if you've ordered something online that still has not arrived. But people who actually work to keep these global supply chains running, they're in a limbo of a different kind. Our China correspondent in Shanghai, the world's Rebecca Canther, spoke with a merchant mariner on a ship that usually carries goods between China and the U.S.
Madeline Walchko is 28 years old. She's from Washington State, and she's the second mate on a container ship that's docked here in Shanghai. The ship is huge, the length of nearly 3 football fields.
So this ship is on what's called the Asia run. The only ports we hit in the United States are LA and Oakland in California.
Her ship arrived in Shanghai in early February. After the crew quarantined and unloaded their cargo, the ship needed some maintenance.
So over the course of these ships' lives, they go through a lot. They get very rusty. They get beat up. You don't really realize how much these ships flex, but they do because they're very long and they're made of metal. So when it's a 22-year-old ship, it requires a massive amount of work.
So the crew hunkered down to wait for the repairs to be finished. They thought it would take about 5 weeks. But then Shanghai's COVID lockdown began, and the shipyard crew was forced to leave before finishing the repairs. So now, Wolchko and her crewmates are stranded in Shanghai, restricted to their ship for nearly 3 months now.
We had to pump, like, rainwater every time it rains. We had a lot of days where we didn't have electricity, multiple days where our toilets wouldn't flush.
Wolchko has been using her photography skills to document the ordeal. She's been regularly uploading videos and photos on Instagram and YouTube.
It's just like a kind of an opportunity in itself to be able to show some of the things that happen to merchant mariners all over the world that no one really gets to see.
Wolchko's video series is a lively production, and it's full of salty language as well. In the first episode, the crew accepts a shipment of food from the Shanghai government to supplement their dwindling supplies. There are peppers, cucumbers, and 8 giant winter melons, each one the size of a toddler. They're common in China, but the U.S.-based crew clearly doesn't know what to do with them.
They boiled it with, like, onions, and it was not very good.
There's even candid interviews with her crewmates.
My time work is 4 to 8 in the morning and 4 to 8 in the afternoon.
Here's one with crew member Ernesto Lagramada, who was born in the Philippines and lives in Seattle.
When is the final words that we are living in this area? Because I'm so really, really homesick. I want to see my tip mom and my farm. I miss my cow. I miss my chicken, I miss my dog, I miss my cat, I miss my goat.
Wolchko says her crewmates have enjoyed being part of the video project.
Yeah, I think it gives people a sense of being heard and seen, and then they can talk to their families through the camera, you know, and their families can watch it over and over again, which has been super sweet. It just melts my heart, being able to provide that.
She says that since the start of the pandemic, extended shipping delays have become more common for merchant mariners.
One of the great parts of shipping, you go to different countries, you can get off the ship and go eat the cuisine and explore a little, and that part of shipping has been totally off the table since 2020 because of COVID.
But the more immediate problem for Wolchko and her crewmates is when they get to leave Shanghai. Repairs are stalled, and their ship is still far from being seaworthy. Wolchko and her crewmates haven't set foot on land for months now.
We're still totally in shambles here. And then we have 3 ports in Asia before we're even able to go back across the ocean to get home after this. It's just so far into the future that I'm not even thinking about it.
For now, Madeline Wolchko says she's just going to keep on documenting the whole experience, hoping to create something from the insanity. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A deadly gang fight in Ecuador last week made international news headlines. The violence involved gunfire, knives, and explosions and took place inside a prison. As brutal as this gang battle was, it was not the first of its kind. The World's Tibisay Zeya has a story.
It was 2 a.m. early last week when residents of the city of Santo Domingo in Ecuador woke up to the sound of gunshots. The gunfire was coming from inside a prison and recorded by neighbors who posted this video on social media. Another video was shared by one of the inmates inside the prison. They're gonna kill us. Please share this video, the man says. He recorded for more than an hour. Again and again, he asks anyone watching to call the police. Meanwhile, local television showed dozens of relatives gathering outside of the prison, desperate for news about what was happening. They are killing prisoners inside, she says. Why is the government not doing anything? The police did show up hours later, and they found a horrifying scene. 43 people were killed at the prison that night. But this is a situation that's becoming all too familiar to Ecuadorians. It has happened 7 times since the beginning of 2021, with close to 400 prisoners killed.
Las cárceles del Ecuador, lo que más hay son armas.
Ecuadorian prisons are full of guns, says Billy Navarrete. He's with the Committee for Human Rights in Ecuador.
Los pabellones donde ellos viven no están.
The police are not really in control of the prisons, Navarrete explains. Gang leaders rule over these prisoners. They're often kidnapped and their relatives have to pay ransom. It happened to one prisoner who was also a local rap artist named Trébol. Trébol's wife, Vanessa Avila, says he was sentenced to 8 months in prison for marijuana possession. She provided testimony to Billy Navarrete's organization.
Los policías me estaban pidiendo dinero. Entonces yo no les di el dinero y ya él lo retuvieron.
She says the police asked for bail money, but she didn't have enough, so her husband had to remain behind bars. Avila says someone contacted her and demanded that she transfer money to a specific bank account every week.
Casi 80, 100 dólares semanales.
She sent $80 to $100 a week, she says, but she didn't know who she was sending money to. Avila explains that her husband served his 8 months and then was not released. 3 months later, he died during one of the deadliest episodes of prison violence in Ecuador. Billy Navarrete says the government is quick to blame the violence on gangs, but he says authorities refuse to take any responsibility for the bloodshed. Most prisoners are serving time for drug-related offenses, Navarrete says, and that includes drug use, which is often not treated as a public health problem, but as a crime. Victims of this violence in Ecuador say they are looking for justice. Vanessa Avila says she's received nothing from authorities since the death of her husband, not even condolences. For the World, I am Tibisay Sea.
The Central African Republic is, as its name suggests, in the center of Africa. It is landlocked, and for years, rebel groups have been fighting against each other and against government forces. They've also been fighting Russian mercenaries. The Wagner Group is run by one of Vladimir Putin's closest associates. The notorious mercenaries are in the Central African Republic to help prop up the government's military, but often they've left behind a trail of atrocities. Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for the Daily Beast. He's based in Nigeria. He's broken stories about Wagner Group's killings in the Central African Republic and joins us from Abuja, the Nigerian capital. So briefly, Philip, the situation in a CAR is a little complicated. Can you just break it down for us?
Oh, yes. Well, this is a country that has been restive since 2013 when a group of Muslim rebels overthrew the government and then took power. But in doing so, they began to act with great brutality. The new president was elected. And in 2017, he went to the UN and said, well, we've been on an arms embargo since 2013 because of the fighting. So we need help. You know, we need to be able to fight the rebels. So since 2017, the Russians or Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group have showed up in Kar.
And when you say CAR, you're of course referring to the Central African Republic, CAR.
As we speak right now in the Central African Republic, only the capital city, Bangui, is controlled by the government. The rest of the country is either held by Christian militias or Muslim rebels. So the Russians came in to help the government protect Bangui.
So the Wagner group sometimes seems more interested in guarding gold mines and other precious resources than the people of the Central African Republic. What is their relationship to the country's natural resources?
One of the bargains from the Russian government was that, yeah, we're going to have control of your mineral resources. So it's no surprise that we're seeing them show up at gold mines and, you know, fighting off rebels. Because before the Russians showed up, a lot of the mines were controlled by rebels.
Well, Philip, you reported a rather detailed expose of a Wagner group massacre near a gold mine. Tell us what happened in that particular case.
So the Russians showed up in this town called Agbado and then began to open fire. And this is always what we see. There's this feeling that, you know, the people of these communities are all working closely with these rebels. And they begin to open fire indiscriminately, shooting at anyone they see outside, which is exactly what happened in Agbado. The killings or the shootings continued, and we had about, you know, over 80 people killed.
So about a week ago, Philip, you tweeted that a senior military official told you that the Wagner group is out of control in the Central African Republic and no one can stand up to them. I mean, it seems that even the government they're supposed to be helping is just as scared of them.
A lot of these members of the Wagner group are people who had trained with some of the elite forces in Russia. It's always going to be difficult for the local forces to stand up against them. And that's why in many cases you see that even when you have a battalion of, you know, soldiers from the Central African Republic military, you always find that, you know, the Russians are the ones dishing out instructions, even punishing CAR military forces.
And reports suggest a lot of these mercenaries have left Central African Republic for Ukraine. What are they doing there?
Basically, what we do know that the Wagner group mercenaries are doing in Ukraine is helping Russian forces fight against the Ukrainian military.
Finally, Philip, in 2020, three Russian journalists went to the Central African Republic to film a documentary about the Wagner group there and their activities. Those journalists were killed. Evidence suggests the Wagner group might have been involved. Do you worry about your own safety when you report on the Wagner group?
What do I worry for my safety? Yeah, I'm concerned, to be honest, yeah.
Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast, telling us about the Russian mercenaries, the Wagner groups fighting in the Central African Republic. Philip's based in Abuja, Nigeria. Philip, thank you for your reporting and stay safe.
It's my pleasure, Marcus. Thank you so much.
The deadly attack in Buffalo again shows the threat posed by white supremacists, a global problem where far-right extremists share ideas across borders.
They're part of this transnational hate movement, which is driven in the online space and kind of solidified in the online space.
Also, a famous play in Kenya returns to the stage after more than 30 years in theatrical exile. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tomorrow, primary voters in Pennsylvania will see a familiar name on the ballot, celebrity physician and television star Dr. Oz. Mehmet Oz has been endorsed by former President Trump and now has a slight lead in recent polls in a crowded race. Oz's parents were born in Turkey. He's a dual citizen, something that opponents have seized on in attack ads. The World's Duri Baskaran in Istanbul reports on how people see him there in his mother's hometown.
Americans know him as Dr. Oz, but at this park in central Istanbul, the guys who sit outside the tea house are gushing about Dr. Mehmet Oz, with two dots over the O. Especially for Turks of a certain age, Dr. Oz is a hometown boy who made it big. We support him. We didn't know he was running for office, but that's good to hear, says Ibrahim Elvaren and Mesut Onger. We see him as one of the most successful people that Turkey produced, Alvaren says. We're very proud of him. Dr. Oz is a household name here, but a divisive one. His TV show has dipped into pseudoscience, faith healing, and fake cures for the coronavirus. Ozan Toraman, a physician and lecturer in Istanbul, says it's unethical for a doctor to use a public platform this way.
There is nothing about real health problems of his country. This is not acceptable for any doctor who cares public health more than his image.
Oz served as a public face for Turkish Airlines, the country's national carrier, acting in ads and voicing in-flight safety videos. For years, the Dr. Oz show aired on Turkish television. In this promo for local viewers, Dr. Oz speaks Turkish with a slight American accent.
Kim demiş sağlıklı yaşam sıkıcıdır diye.
Mehmet Oz was born in Cleveland, Ohio, to Turkish parents, and grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. In the 80s, Oz served 2 years of compulsory military service in Turkey before pursuing his medical career in the U.S. He doesn't seem to spend much time in the Pennsylvania home where he claims to live, appearing to prefer his longtime New Jersey mansion. That's earned him criticism from opponents. So has his Turkish dual citizenship, which is often referenced in attack ads put out by his Republican opponents.
Mehmet Oz will betray conservatives. After high school in Delaware, Oz didn't fight for America. He served for the Turkish army instead.
In another ad released by a liberal political group, Oz is accused of being cozy with the Turkish president and voting in Turkey's election in 2018.
His election would represent a clear and present danger to the United States. Pennsylvania, stop Mehmet Oz before it's too late.
Oz responded to claims that his Turkish citizenship would be a security threat on the right-wing website Newsmax.
I have no idea. It was a cheap shot. Really wasn't anything but a distraction to the campaign.
He says his mom has Alzheimer's and lives in Istanbul, where he visits regularly. It's easier to travel there if he's a citizen.
Our heritage is something we should all be proud of. It is bigotry to say anything otherwise.
There's no law against dual citizens serving as senators. Oz says he'll give up his Turkish citizenship if he's elected, like members of Congress Ted Cruz and Michelle Bachmann did with their Canadian and Swiss citizenships after facing criticism. Gürkan Özel, an economics student, sits outside the Istanbul coffee shop where she works. She says she likes Dr. Oz. He seems like a good person. She liked the show. She didn't know he was running for Senate. When I tell her he's endorsed by Donald Trump, her face falls. We used to know him as someone who was sincere, warm, and reliable, who wouldn't let people down, she says. Seeing him choose this political path, following Trump, is very disappointing, she adds. She thinks Trump's economic policies and sanctions made the economic crisis here worse. Nearby, Nurettin Uzumcu watches his daughter play on a playground. I don't know much about Dr. Oz, Uzumcu says, but it seems like he'd be a good senator.
Bence olur. Yani çünkü sonuçta bildiğim kadarıyla.
He has a good image and he represents Turkey well, Uzumcu says. Primary voters in Pennsylvania will get their say tomorrow. If he wins in November's general election, Oz will be the country's first Muslim senator. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin in Istanbul.
Change seems to be in the air in Lebanon. Voters there went to the polls this weekend. As we reported on the show last week, new political faces and many Lebanese voters had seen these parliamentary elections as an opportunity to move past Lebanon's cycle of political mismanagement and corruption. To talk about what the results so far mean is Leila Molana Allen. She's a freelance reporter and joins us from Beirut. So with results still coming in, Leila, what is the big takeaway?
It was pretty cast down this weekend, very apathetic. Voter turnout, of course, only at about 41% and at 3% up in Tripoli, which is the poorest area in Lebanon, where you would think that people would want change. But of course, it was just such a sign that people don't feel they can achieve change within this current political system in Lebanon. All the results are not confirmed yet, but at the moment, what does seem clear is that there's a strong chance that Hezbollah will lose their majority. And that's made up of what's called a blocking third in Lebanon, which means that if you have an alliance that has enough votes in parliament, you can essentially decide what legislation passes or does not pass based on that. Now, Hezbollah, with their alliance with the President Michel Aoun's Free Patriotic Movement Party and several other parties, have held that in the previous parliament. It looks like they're going to lose that. Not only that, but President Aoun's party seemed to have lost some seats, and the Lebanese forces, who, unlike President Aoun's party, are very against Hezbollah, seem to have gained seats. If they are now the biggest Christian party in the parliament. That's very bad news for Hezbollah because they can't continue that alliance, which has given them so much power in the last few years.
Well, as you've alluded to, this vote was supposed to be a major test for Lebanon's independent candidates. As you look at these results coming in, is there anything that looks like it could be an actual functioning opposition bloc that could lead?
No, we're nowhere near that. But it is a huge shift. This time we have seen a difference. We have seen that actually people have broken with tradition. They have, in some places, voted for new people. And it's a very small change if we do have around a dozen of these new, fresh-faced or opposition MPs who have changed their minds and decided they don't want to work with the established parties. But it does show that what people have been saying for so long, there is no way that there can be change within this current system in Lebanon, is not necessarily the case. And a lot of Lebanese have been saying to me the last few weeks, whether I stay or leave the country now, of course, we know so many hundreds of thousands already have, will depend on this election. Some of those people are now saying maybe there is a chance. Not that huge this time, but it's the beginning of something.
With so much at stake in Lebanon, and the political dysfunction is extraordinary. It seems stunning that there was low voter turnout. What does that mean about the fresh faces actually representing a majority of Lebanese?
There were not that many fresh faces, it should be said first. But those that were had very good roots within the universities, within the protest movement that started in 2019 here, had worked with lots of grassroots organizations, something that we've seen over the last few years with those protest groups all turned into civil society groups, into civil action groups. They made their connections there. So these are people who have proven themselves, who are trusted. And it's the very beginning of it, but they are showing that it can be a different kind of politician in Lebanon who is not just there because their father was in power, because their family has money, because they have the right contacts. And that makes a difference to people.
So it seems like there's a crack and some light is starting to get through. But how much optimism is there among Lebanese that things could actually get better right now?
Immediately what happens now is that this new parliament, however it is made up, which we'll find out for sure tonight, tomorrow morning, they then have to get a prime minister in place. That historically takes months. What these new candidates are saying is they will not allow these politicians to sit on their laurels and just pick and choose what suits them and negotiate over favours for each other to get a prime minister in place. They want it now so they can start having action. The first thing once that happens is that there is this deal finally that looks like it will go through, which is this IMF deal. That's still only $3 billion. That's a drop in the ocean compared to what this country needs. So right now, it is a case of survival. I've spent a lot of time in soup kitchens here and local charity organizations, and they're all saying, you know, people who used to be donors are now coming to use their services and they don't know how much longer they can hold out. So it's a desperate situation. And this election result will not change that anytime soon.
Reporter Leila Molana Allen in Beirut, helping us understand the results of this weekend's parliamentary elections in Lebanon. Leila, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Kenya, a play once banned there is finally getting its due. It was written by one of the country's legends, Gogi Watiango. Decades ago, he was forced into exile because of his controversial and critical body of work. This week, though, one of his most famous plays came back after more than 30 years. Here's the world's Halima Gikandi.
At the National Theatre in downtown Nairobi, a crowd eagerly waits to see a play that hasn't been shown officially since the 1990s. Gaika Deda in the Kikuyu language means I will marry when I want. It's co-written by Gogi Watiango and Gogi Wameri. As the lights dim and the band begins to play, the cast bursts into song as they dance down the aisles. They're playing the parts of poor villagers in the newly independent nation of Kenya. For actress Nice Githinji, this is a production she's been waiting for a long time.
Wow, we've all known about it for so long. I knew about it when I was in high school, I think. Yeah, I think it's a play that most of us grew up either read it or knew that it was there.
Githinji plays a poor rural woman named Wangeshi. She and her husband are told by a wealthy Kenyan family that they're living in sin. They're pressured into having a proper Christian marriage. But in the end, they wind up losing their land in their effort. For Githinji, it's a necessary, though rare, criticism of Christianity in Kenya.
The thing that keeps on jumping out of the page for me is just how we forgot that we had our traditional ways of praying. We had our traditional ways of speaking to whichever creator is out there. And they just came and shoved the Bible down our throats. And with that came colonialism.
Religion is only one of the sensitive issues in the play. It also highlights the violence of British colonialism and criticizes the new Kenyan leadership during those early days of independence. I meet 26-year-old Mweni Mwando in this crowd. She tells me how now she understands why the play was so controversial.
Watching it, I understand why he was arrested. It makes so much sense. It puts two and two together, but it's such a relevant play.
She means why Gogiwa Thiong'o, the author, was arrested shortly after this play was first performed in 1977. Mwando tells me the themes about class and elitism in Kenya are still relevant today. I was able to speak with Thiong'o over the phone, and I asked him how he decided to tackle these issues. He says the play actually came out of adult education and literacy programs that he and other activists were conducting outside of Nairobi.
So theater was going to be also be very good because they would, of course, act in a play, and others could come and join the theater at the level of playing.
The themes in the play, he tells me, came out of the real struggles of poor people in those programs. They were also struggling to come to terms with a newly independent and unequal Kenya. The play spoke to the truth, and that, Thiong'o says, made the play dangerous, especially in the eyes of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta.
Kenyatta now puts me in a maximum security prison. For writing a play.
Thiong'o spent many years in exile. He now lives and teaches in the United States. I asked him how he feels about this play coming back home now.
When it was, I heard they were playing it again, or no matter what format, I was of course happy.
For him, it's a signal that Kenya has changed and become more open. Guy Gadeda premiered this week and will continue for the rest of the month. It's being performed in two languages, the original Kikuyu and in English. Some of the actors told me they were concerned that the play might not translate well. But as the play came to a close, it was evident the message was heard loud and clear. Mweni Mwando in the audience tells me this is a play all Kenyans should watch, especially now as they're preparing to elect a new president in August.
This is the best time for this play to come back up right now, because now we have to think about who are we putting in that seat.
For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
As the war in Ukraine grinds on, the Biden administration still has to pay attention to other parts of the globe. Last week, the focus was on Southeast Asia. President Biden hosted regional leaders for an historic in-person gathering in Washington. The two-day meeting was meant to show that the U.S. remains committed to Southeast Asia. But as Ashley Westerman reports, the summit is receiving mixed reviews.
On its face, the gathering was historic. Never before had leaders from ASEAN, the 10-country Association of Southeast Asian Nations, been called as a group to Washington. Sitting at dinner Friday, President Joe Biden told the leaders of Vietnam, Singapore, and Thailand, among others, that they were launching a new era in relations.
And as we look around the world, all the challenges we're facing, the ASEAN-U.S. partnership is critical, I think, to meeting the moment we find ourselves in history right now.
But some experts and Southeast Asia watchers say the administration came up short.
As far as I can tell, there were no specific deliverables from this historic U.S.-ASEAN summit at the White House.
Derek Grossman is a senior defense analyst at RAND Corporation. He says even the main commitment announced is laughable. $150 million for the region's pandemic preparedness and infrastructure.
I think it's pretty insulting, to be honest, to pledge such a paltry amount to a region that Biden himself, in remarks at the White House during the summit, he said that ASEAN centrality is, quote, at the heart of his administration's Indo-Pacific strategy.
While not explicitly anti-China, many parts of the strategy are clearly aimed at countering Beijing's economic power in the region. Grossman says not releasing more details about the Indo-Pacific strategy's economic framework was a missed opportunity.
I mean, when you look at what China's doing on the other side of the ledger here, I mean, they're literally investing billions with a B.
That's through Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative, a trillions of dollars program seeking to establish a vast network of investment and infrastructure spanning Asia, Europe, and Africa. Mark Mealy is with the D.C.-based U.S. ASEAN Business Council. He says compared to the $40 billion in aid to Ukraine Congress just approved, that $150 million may not stand out. But other notable commitments were made, such as appointing a U.S. envoy to ASEAN.
I think there's lots of other initiatives that at the end of the day really do offer some tangible benefits in terms of strengthening U.S.-ASEAN economic relationships.
But for a region that feels perpetually ignored by the U.S., was the summit worth it? Hunter Marston, an associate with Nine Dash Line based in Canberra, says reactions from some Southeast Asian leaders, such as Singapore and Indonesia, have been positive.
I think the Biden administration walked a fine line in not pushing ASEAN states too hard to either break ties with Russia entirely, which it understands is unrealistic given Russia's strategic importance to many Southeast Asian countries, and also not to sort of choose sides in this competition with China.
But Marston says that Southeast Asian leaders want more specifics, particularly on how the U.S. can help them economically. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
The terrorist shooting in Buffalo on Saturday highlights a growing threat posed by far-right extremism, not just in the U.S., but across the globe. 10 people were killed and 3 others injured after a white gunman went on a shooting rampage at a supermarket in Buffalo. 11 of the victims were black. Amarnath Amarasingham is a professor at Queen's University in Ontario and an expert on extremism. He helped authenticate the 180-page document the Buffalo shooter published online. Amarasingham says the shooter wrote that he was deeply influenced by the white supremacist who killed 51 Muslims in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2019.
He basically says, I plagiarized the New Zealand shooter because he's already said everything I wanted to say, so there's no point in me reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Our first impulse often is to think of a terrible shooting like this as a domestic thing, but you're alluding to the Christchurch shooter and the last 27 pages of this shooter's document. It is a global phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the far-right movement now, it has domestic expression, I would say. You know, his attack is very much a kind of anti-black, anti-African-American attack, whereas in other parts of the world that have been inspired by this movement, the victims have been the Muslim community or immigrants or refugee centers, that sort of thing. And so they're part of this transnational hate movement, which is driven in the online space and kind of solidified in the online space, but it manifests itself on the ground, colored by kind of domestic politics in a way. So for him, he's still part of this transnational thinking of white genocide and the great replacement that he feels is happening in parts of Europe and other parts of the world. But for him, the way it plays out in his local context is through anti-black racism.
Amarnath, what do we know about how these sorts of extremists are learning from one another around the world?
The online community is quite powerful. They share these manifestos around. They have long-running conversations on some of these more darker corners of the internet about what's happening to the white community and this kind of emergency mindset, I would say, right? This idea of the white population is being slowly eroded and killed off, and that's being deliberately planned and carried out by kind of a shadowy cabal of Jewish media, you know, people who control the media and control the banks and control politics, et cetera. So it's very much woven into a kind of conspiratorial mindset of demographic takeover. And you can see it dripping throughout his old manifesto, which is this like someone needs to do something right away kind of phenomenon. And that part of it is also dangerous because it creates the impression that this is a kind of moral emergency for them that they need to react to before it's too late.
So again, let's scrutinize the word theory here, as in great replacement theory. That does seem to give these ideas more weight than they deserve.
It's not a theory, it's a conspiracy theory. They believe that there is a deliberate campaign by evildoers, most often the Jewish community, to kind of deliberately put plans into place to kill off the white race, right? So whether that's manufacturing policy that would increase immigration or refugees, whether that's propaganda through the media to convince the rest of us that immigration is a good thing, they believe it's a kind of orchestrated plan to kill off the white people, basically. And so this notion of the white genocide that's happening, that's part of what drives, at least in this case, this kind of sense of urgency and emergency that we need to, you know, that he needs to do something and someone needs to act. And he needs to inspire other attackers and the next generation of attackers to kind of do something as well. There's this very interesting, or, you know, I use interesting in quotes, in part of his manifesto where he says, I don't want to die, right? I want to be arrested alive. I want to be taken in alive because I want to see from jail whether what I did actually accomplished anything. And he fully expects, he says, to kind of be released from prison and celebrated once this kind of race war begins. And so there is this kind of sense of an impending liberation or awakening within white consciousness that's supposed to vindicate his actions. And all of these attackers from New Zealand to El Paso onward will be celebrated as the people who led the charge, I guess, to wake up a sleeping masses.
Have you found that kind of thinking with the other attackers like at Christchurch or in El Paso?
There was a 16-year-old who was arrested in Singapore who was influenced by great replacement ideas, and the Poway synagogue shooter also influenced by great replacement ideas. And so it's become a kind of powerful consolidator of various different ideas, I think, in the far-right space. And it's becoming, as some people have noted recently, you know, it's becoming much more mainstreamed as well through platforms like Fox News and Tucker Carlson and others who may not use the words great replacement precisely, but they kind of peddle in those ideas that somehow, you know, the very slogan Make America Great Again, right, is idea that something about what it means to be a true American is being eroded. Western culture is in danger and somebody needs to do something about it is becoming much more mainstream, which is deeply worrisome, I would say.
How do these global extremists communicate with one another?
Sometimes they don't, right? I think there's this assumption, I think through our Al-Qaeda lens or the ISIS lens, that somehow these are fully fledged organizations where there's a hierarchy and a leadership and things like that. Doesn't necessarily exist in the kind of far-right movement that we're seeing now. These are much more nebulous networks of people who are just reading each other's content, often anonymously. I mean, they're not out there with their real name and location or anything like that. And so they're kind of part of this broader social movement, extremist movement, transnationally organized is the wrong word, but you know what I mean. But the attack often happens through these kind of lone actor attacks, right? So all of these individuals take it upon themselves to put this ideology into effect individually and domestically and locally, but the broader ideology still remains.
Help us understand how these fringe twisted ideas went mainstream so rapidly in so much of the world.
I mean, it really got going, I would say, after the Syrian migrant crisis in 2015. It was then that groups like Generation Identity in Europe really got speaking in this kind of language of we are being overrun, right? That there is a mass migration of, in this case, Muslims from Syria who are not going to integrate, who are not going to assimilate to our way of life, who are slowly going to erode kind of the purity of Western culture and so on. That kind of started around that time. Before that, you had Renaud Camus' book called The Great Replacement, published in 2011 in French, where he kind of initially began discussion of these great replacement ideas.
That's Renaud Camus.
Renaud Camus, yeah. Renaud Camus' book, at least a shorter version of it, was translated into English. A lot of American and Canadian far-right influencers on YouTube and other platforms were very much linked to this broader alt-right Generation Identity scene as well. And so you had ideas seeping in through those people. And they became, just when we say YouTube celebrities, it's kind of dismisses their importance, but some of them became quite influential far-right talking heads with, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers and putting out content regularly and so on. And then I would say it was fully mainstreamed under the Trump administration, right? This idea that something about what it meant to be a true American was being eroded and that this was happening with some sort of deep state cabal came out of the mouth of the president himself.
Amarnath Amarasingham is an assistant professor of religion at Queen's University in Ontario and a far-right terrorism expert. Amarnath, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Thank you for listening. From PR.